Welcome on to a Monday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. We have a big trade that just happened. Maybe more like a medium-sized trade. I don't know. But to tell us whether it's a big trade or a medium-sized trade, salary cap guru, NBC Sports writer, former writer at Piston Powered, Dan Feldman. How you doing, man?
Good. Current writer at Piston Powered, too.
Oh. Fair enough. We'll talk. Dan and I talk every once in a while on GChat about various boring salary cap minutia, and so he always shows up pretty high on my GChat window because he's got a D. And every time I see him in there, I think of Feldman, the Bizarro Kramer from the Bizarro Jerry episode of Seinfeld. Dan probably didn't even know that until I just told him. Maybe it's a little embarrassing to share that now. How does that make you feel, Dan?
You know, it just brings back memories. I had a friend in high school who used to like that reference. I haven't heard that one in years.
Well, I can assure you all that Dan has a much better haircut than Feldman on that Seinfeld episode does.
Did he have a bad haircut?
Yeah, he had like the sort of like crew cut, like that's like sort of like crew cut flat cut or crew cut flat top on a white dude. Like, not like the sort of Johnny Unitas haircut you can set your watch to type of thing.
Well, if I have a better haircut, it's only dumb luck, because obviously I don't know the style well enough to know what's good and what's not.
Well, these are, the benefits of being cap dorks is that we have no understanding of what current style is. But it all just feeds into our dorky images, so people will believe what we're talking about when it comes to the cap. So let's get into this trade at no worse than the second best Daniel to appear on this podcast regularly. Spencer Hawes and Matt Barnes to Charlotte for Lance Stephenson going to the Clippers. What were your initial thoughts when you heard about this? It just came down the pike from Woj about an hour and a half ago.
Well, my first thought was that teams should probably try to avoid Lance Stephenson. But I don't know. I don't hate the Clippers taking a chance on him. They're definitely buying low. I mean, to think they can get somebody who a year ago was right in the discussion of being an all-star who's still really young and on a cheap contract if he plays like he did 2 years ago. Maybe it's the right time to buy low. Maybe I can talk myself into liking it for the Clippers. I don't know. What'd you think?
Well, he only has one more guaranteed year of salary. And he's under team control for another year after that. So he's $9 million this year and then has a team option for $9.4 million next year. So if he works out, then great, you still have him under contract. If not, no harm, no foul, I guess. Doc is certainly not someone who has been shy about moving on from people who don't work out. So that might work for them. I think that from a basketball standpoint, it's interesting because, obviously Lance is much younger than Matt Barnes, but Matt Barnes was clearly a much better player and really the only thing approximating a 3-and-D guy on the Clippers roster. I think that Stephenson could be a little better defensively than Barnes. I don't know that he's quite stopper-level a guy on the wings. And then you also have to consider that Lance is not really a good shooter. I mean, he was shot okay, low 30s in Indiana, but he's just not a natural shooter. He's got pretty ugly form, really regressed last year in Charlotte. So I worry now about their spacing when you already have two guys, assuming Jordan is re-signed. You got Griffin at the four. Neither of those two guys shoot threes. J.J. Redick is someone who can shoot threes, but then Paul is a three-point shooter, but not someone that you think of as really a spacer. So I don't know. We'll see. It's a risk. It gives them someone else who can attack off the dribble, but I'm not quite sure that I like it when you're giving up someone who was on a pretty cheap contract and actually was pretty good for them last year. He shot about 40% on threes, Barnes did.
Right. You mentioned age, and that's one reason I lean toward liking this for the Clippers. I mean, last year I would have rather had Barnes, both probably in a vacuum and for his fit with the Clippers, but Barnes is going to be 36 next year. I'm not going to assume Barnes at 36 is still going to be better than Lance at 25. And maybe Lance bounces back a little bit, and maybe that's enough. But the fit issues you mentioned, I think, are big. You know, is he going to be taking the ball from Chris Paul if he starts? Obviously not, but what can he do off the ball? Is he going to have just duplicating skills with Jamal Crawford if he comes off the bench? Probably, although maybe they look to move Crawford now. They have a big hole at small forward. I look at defensively, maybe he's better than Barnes, though I think Barnes is an underrated defender. But the type of players he's going to defend are similar to the type of guys J.J. Redick's going to defend. And I think Redick's an underrated defender. I don't like to put too much stock into how is he going to stop LeBron or how are they going to stop Durant. But when you're the Clippers, that's your goal. You want to win a championship. You're probably going to run into one of those guys, maybe both. Do you have somebody on the roster? Is that Stevenson? Can he guard those bigger threes?
I think that he, and you'll remember in those last two playoffs, he got some time on LeBron and did okay. You know, Paul George was, when I say last year, I mean 2013, 2014, Paul George was the main guy, obviously, guarding LeBron. But if he got in foul trouble, Lance did an okay job. Lance has a little bit more heft to him than some other guys. I think he can definitely guard the vast majority of threes in the league, and you would have to imagine that he would start at the three. And also, I think he somewhat lessens your issues with the second unit and their perennial backup point guard struggles. So he's now someone who can create with the second unit a little more. He was very effective in that role in Indiana, and that's not something that he really did much in Charlotte. You know, Charlotte was such a poor fit for him because of all of their lack of shooters, he couldn't really get to the basket. And also worth noting as well that he struggled a lot with injuries. He had a sprained pelvis, which does not sound particularly nice, and a few other issues that I can't bring to mind right now. So he may bounce back just from a health perspective as well, and I think they feel like they can keep him in line, at least from a personality standpoint.
Well, I think that's the big thing, and we can talk about his fit on the court with Charlotte, but I just never got the sense he got along with those guys, and given how well they gelled the year before in that surprising run of the playoffs, I'm inclined to put that more on Lance than them, and maybe that changes with the Clippers. Maybe that veteran locker room is better for him, but I don't know. It's a big city. There's a lot of potential distractions for him. I don't love the word distractions, but I think it applies here. I have a lot of fit concerns. This is where Doc is really going to earn his money. You know, he's putting this on himself, that he's going to make this work. And I think it's more than off the court. I think he needs to do what Larry Bird did for Lance with the Pacers and help him mature and be a person who can contribute to your basketball team.
Well, so let's talk about now where this leaves the Clippers from a financial standpoint. You know, they move on from Hawes. I think that was one of the appeals here. Would you say that Hawes's contract is worse than Stevenson's contract?
That's an interesting question. I mean, it's obviously less.
It goes on longer, right?
It goes on longer. He's making about $5.5 to $6 million for the next 3 years, two guaranteed and then a player option, which is probably guaranteed. I would agree with that because he's older, and the guy who signed him, Doc Rivers signed Hawes. I guess we all just assumed he had a plan for fitting Hawes in. He obviously didn't. Hawes never really meshed with that team, and Doc abandoned him in the playoffs, so, and I think that hurt Hawes' value. So, yeah, I'd agree that Hawes was a worse contract, but you're taking a greater risk in the short term with Lance Stevenson because he makes more right now.
Yeah, but, I mean, they were always going to be over the tax if they re-signed DeAndre Jordan anyway, so assuming Ballmer's willing to pay, not much opportunity cost this year. If Jordan leaves, you could say, oh, Hawes was their insurance policy, but you know, you're not getting to a championship level with DJ leaving and Hawes as your starting center anyway. And they're always going to offer DJ the max, I think. So it's not like he now has more negotiating leverage. They're going to offer him the most they can pay anyway, you would think. So, you know, I think I like it from that perspective. And then it opens up another $5.5 million or so in the summer of 2016 for the Clippers with Hawes now off the books and Stevenson potentially expiring if they want to decline his team option.
One question I've been circling around with this trade is how much do I like it if DeAndre Jordan re-signs and how much do I like it if he leaves? And I've gone back and forth on that a little bit. I think if Jordan leaves, this is a good thing to increase their variance. I'm not sure I really don't think they're a championship level team without Jordan, but I don't know, you know, if Lance Stephenson goes back to where he left off with the Pacers and makes that next step that he seemed he could make given his age, you know, maybe he's that third star that, that makes everything click, if, especially if they use the mid-level exception well to round out their roster. Maybe that pushes them in. If Jordan re-signs, I thought the Clippers were good enough with maybe a little bit better luck than they had this year, and more so the luck being you don't run into an all-time great team with the Warriors and in the playoffs and in the same, you know, in the same conference as you, maybe you have a better chance of winning a championship. So I don't know if Jordan comes back, I don't necessarily like the Clippers making a big risk.
Well, I think it might be worthwhile in that perspective. I think there are a lot of people who would say that they were not a championship caliber team this year. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. I think, you know, they didn't, their bench was kind of the big problem. And this doesn't necessarily open, you know, fix those wounds at all. You know, you're replacing someone in Barnes who, well, he's probably overmatched as your primary 3 and D guy, at least as a rotation caliber guy. And you're taking away Hawes, who was kind of your hope there as a, you know, a rotation caliber guy coming off the bench. Maybe they feel like they can roll, you know, with someone like Glenn Davis again, or get some another third big now with the mini mid-level. So to be clear, you meant the mini mid-level there, right?
Exactly. Assuming
that DJ comes back, because they'll be, you know, run into some issues with the tax there. So, yeah, I think now, though, not having a third big, are you better off with what might be an upgrade, not guaranteed to be an upgrade over Barnes, but now you're opening up another hole in the front court? I think what Doc would tell you is, well, this guy wasn't any good anyway. You know, we were no better off really having him, so it's better to just get off of his salary. And maybe Doc the coach at least would say that, not Doc the GM who signed with the full mid-level last summer.
Yeah, I agree with that in the sense that if Doc didn't believe in Hawes, and it seems pretty clear that he didn't, yeah, that's fine to move on. And I think, you know, cheap free agent, they could probably find somebody to fill the confidence at least that, that Doc had in Hawes. I don't necessarily agree with that, Doc, in that that maybe if I were in charge, I'd find a little more time for Hawes. I think he's a better player than Doc gave him credit for and the way he used him. But to me, the big loss is Barnes. You know, you're losing a small forward who I think was pretty underrated talent-wise and who fit well with this team. I think that's the big hole you need to fit. I'm not as confident as you that Stephenson can guard those premier small forwards. And if you're the Clippers, I think you have to game plan for those kinds of guys when your goal should be high. I think their goal should be a championship when you have Chris Paul and Blake Griffin.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think this is certainly a high-risk move by the Clippers. Maybe it's high reward, but it's also, it's only 1 year, and this may kind of evolve into a little bit more of a transition year, but and you know, where they try to add some more salary in 2016, and this positions them to do that better. But the problem is with Chris Paul just having turned 30, and Blake, even really a guy dependent on athleticism, he's probably right in his prime, if not even on the tail end of it now. Jordan, same thing, assuming that he returns. So are you now like putting this year in jeopardy a little bit? I think you alluded to that, and that's the potential downside of this move.
Well, I think DeAndre Jordan puts this year in jeopardy. If he's back, I think this team can contend. If he's not, I see the only real path to contention is either you can swing some type of sign and trade for somebody like Tyson Chandler, or Lance Stephenson, against all odds, turns into that budding star we thought he could be when he was finishing up with the Pacers.
Yeah, so that's I think that's a good summary, and now really it's going to depend what they can do as far as finding a backup big and finding a little more depth. You know, I assume they'll bring back Austin Rivers. I mean, I think if you have Stevenson, Crawford, and maybe get a little something out of Rivers like they did in the playoffs, that might be good enough as backups along the guard line. You know, Stevenson will start, but he'll play a lot with the second unit as kind of a primary guy, and I think he'll be good in that role. But yeah, just finding, and especially finding another wing too who you could go small with, maybe with bench units, would be nice. So it's all going to be up to Doc now to find somebody do better than he has, getting kind of off the scrappy talent. And they're really going to have just minimum contracts, and they're going to have that mini mid-level at $3.4 million. Maximum you can offer for that is 3 years. That's about all they have back in the cupboard because their 2015 draft pick is traded, and so is 2017.
Well, I want to jump back to one thing you said about Lance and Austin Rivers and Jamal Crawford. I think talent-wise, yeah, that's a decent group off the bench, but their skills overlap so much that I don't think you're going to get the best out of any of them, and you don't have other guys who are capable, really, of playing and making big contributions off the bench. So I don't really like that as a unit. I think this should come with another move, and we've, you know, heard rumors and reports for a while now that they're dangling Jamal Crawford or Jamal Crawford in a first-round pick, you know, trying to find that 3-and-D forward. And so I think this should be, I don't know how Doc views it, but I think this should be the first of at least one other move to make this deal complete.
It does make Crawford slightly more redundant now that you have another creator, theoretically, in Stevenson, but I don't really know how good his trade value is with his $5.6 million salary for next year, which is partially non-guaranteed. But, I don't think that he's getting you anybody who's even a rotation-quality big in trade when you consider his age, that he had the fact he had a down year this year. Who's giving up a rotation big for Jamal Crawford? I wouldn't.
Yeah, I wouldn't either. I think the selling point has to be the first-round pick, and his salary can be used for a team that, you know, wants a solid guard off the bench. He's not going to be the big appeal. I think the big appeal will be the first, and his salary can be used to make salaries match.
But what first-round pick are you talking about?
They've got to have one they haven't given up, right?
Do they, Dan? Do they? Well, I think they have 2015 is traded away. They did that for, I can't remember which one was Doc and which one was Dudley. I think 2015 was Doc, and then 2017 is Dudley. So you're really looking at hopefully 2019 if you're lucky, and I think 2017 is protected, so it might have to be just 2 years after 2017 or later is traded away. So, you know, maybe you can get rid of that one, but gosh, I mean, I wouldn't want to throw away another first-round pick if I were them. That's for sure.
Yeah, they could trade their 2021 pick, the way the protections work out. You know, you mentioned it with Chris Paul getting a little older. This is the time to put your chips in. You know, I don't love trading first-round picks out like this, and the Dudley trade I thought was a mistake at the time, and hindsight even more so. But just because you made that mistake once doesn't mean you should shy away from that thinking again of trading picks to get immediate help. To dump a player, I don't know. But to get immediate help, I wouldn't be opposed to them trading another first-round pick.
Yeah, I mean, if they can get a real awesome third big who can play both power forward and center adequately when DeAndre and Blake are both out of the game, then, yeah, I think that would clearly be worth it. But, you know, it's definitely risky. I mean, you could look back at the Warriors. They traded away 2014 and 2017 first-round picks to get Andre Iguodala. Well, you know, the way he's played in the finals, that sure was worth it, right? Like, so, you know, I suppose you can start to fetishize first-round picks a little bit too much once you're in a position to really go for it. But on the other hand, if you want to maintain your long-term health as a franchise, you want to try to avoid those sorts of quick fixes. So, all right, why don't we look at this now from the Charlotte perspective? What do you think of it from their end?
Well, do you think they're going to start Spencer Hawes next to Al Jefferson and have a good balance of floor spacing and interior scoring and give up 300 points a game? Or what do you think they're going to do? Or do you think Hawes will come off the bench?
Oh, man. Yeah, you have to imagine that Hawes is going to come off the bench. I mean, Jefferson defensively is inadequate as a center, and just imagining him or Hawes trying to chase around any kind of stretch four on the perimeter is a bit of a nightmare, and especially because Hawes is not a good enough post player that he's really going to punish putting a smaller guy on him. So if you think of it, what I would do if they were starting both those guys is I'd put my center on Jefferson and say, all right, you know, we're going to either go small with a stretch four or another wing guy and just run Hawes right off the floor. So I don't really like that too much. I mean, you're ostensibly trying to develop Cody Zeller. You're trying to develop Vonleh. You would hope that those guys could develop to the point where they might be a nice big rotation around Jefferson with their youth and mobility. So I don't know. Let's put your Rich Cho hat on here. Other than simply opening up another $4 million in space this year, which probably is not really going to help you that much. I mean, well, yeah, so why don't we do this, actually? Sorry to contradict myself. Let's set the scene now for where they're at now that they've acquired these guys in terms of space, assuming Al Jefferson opts in, as has been reported.
Well, let me take one step back real quick with what you. So you mentioned we're talking about the fit, and you know maybe it's not great with Jefferson, and it's hard to really see this on the court as this great thing. If I'm the Clippers, and Charlotte is talking about making this trade with me, and I look at Charlotte's roster and what I think of Spencer Hawes and you know where Matt Barnes is, especially because the latest reports are that the Hornets will probably waive Matt Barnes. If I'm the Clippers, I got to be wondering myself, man, do they just want to really get rid of Lance Stephenson? Like, are they just willing to take, you know, a backup big and a guy they're going to waive just to get rid of him? And what does that say about him? Maybe they're the problem, or maybe Stevenson's the problem. Like, so when you talk about his personality, I think the fact that Charlotte made this trade is a pretty big red flag.
Yeah, although they, because of those fit issues that he had there, he simply was not going to be effective with the lack of shooting that they have, with the offense centered around Jefferson in the post. And yeah, when someone's making $9 million, when, you know, I don't think there are any specific reports of him being a malcontent last year, and he actually had a couple of interviews where he seemed like relatively cool with it. But you know, having that guy be on your bench for so long, making that amount of money as just a malcontent, knowing he's about to be a free agent, I think that might have been considered somewhat untenable for this team. So maybe that's the reason, although, you know, certainly it's, I mean, Stevenson has plenty of red flags, starting with the way he played last year, but I think Doc believes he can rehabilitate him a little bit.
Do you think Gerald Henderson will opt out? He's at $6 million for next year.
That's a good question. I mean, I was thinking about that, you know, and I think it's tough. Because the 3-and-D guys are in vogue. He's got the D. He's pretty athletic, but he just can't really shoot three-pointers. And so he has limited utility. I probably wouldn't sign him to $6 million. I mean, when they signed him to that, it was when they were not very good. When he was pretty young, it was kind of a bet that he might develop into a little bit better of a shooter. He hasn't at this point. He's getting to where he's in his prime, and you can't necessarily expect that any longer. I think I would probably opt in if I were him to that $6 million. I, as a rival GM, I don't think I would pay him $6 million on a multi-year deal to go somewhere else.
Yeah, I'm with you. If I were him, he's got a probable starting job. Why not stay? Wait till the cap goes up, and you know, I don't think he's going to be any worse next year than he was this year. I think he's sort of stagnated, but if anything, I think it's more likely he plays a little better than a little worse.
So let's look at where they are at now. Let's say they've got Al Jefferson, $13.5 million salary, Marvin Williams, $7 million, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, $6.3 million, Zeller, $4.2 million, Bismack Biyombo is a restricted free agent. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I don't think they're going to give Biyombo the qualifying offer. That it could go either way, but my guess is that he won't be a restricted free agent, that his qualifying offer for a little more than $4 million is just going to be a little too steep.
Yeah, that may be true. And then they've got Brian Roberts, $2.8 million, Noah Vonleh, $2.6 million, P.J. Harrison, $1.2 million, and then you've got Troy Daniels at the minimum. So
I think we, unless I misheard you, I think we skipped over Kemba Walker at $12 million, too.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, thanks. He's kind of important, too. So anyway, assuming that everyone is in now, Barnes is $3.5 million, they can release him and have him only be $1 million. That leaves them really, you know, not a ton of room, probably only about like $7 or $8 million or so, assuming that they were to waive Barnes.
Well, I've got them over the cap unless Henderson opts out, and depending where things fall, they could be just over a mid-level exception worth of room. But I think they're going to be dealing with the mid-level exception, the full or just slightly over.
Yeah, okay, actually, yeah, that's $5 million above I'm looking at on my spreadsheet, not $5 million below. Oops. Well, anyway, that would include the Biyombo qualifying offer as well. But yeah, I mean, so they're they're probably going to be over unless Jefferson were to opt out, which he says he's not. What about him? Would you opt out if you were him of that $13.5 million? He's, as he enters his 30s?
I wouldn't. I think that's a good chance for him to probably make the most he'll make. And he'll go onto the market in 2016 when the cap goes up, and there'll be teams who will want him. No, I would opt in and take that one more, especially because the Hornets have been good to him. His stock was never higher than it was after his first year there. Steve Clifford knows how to use him defensively to make the best of his ability. Like, if wherever his value is going to be the highest going into 2016, I think it's going to be after a season with the Hornets.
Yeah, that may be true. I mean, I might have opted out to see if I could get them to fork over a little bit longer term of a contract, but, you know, maybe they wouldn't have been interested in doing that. I think it's not obvious to me either way, but anyway, yeah, so looking like here, now that they have this, they do have theoretically, you know, $4 more million in space, but they're probably going to be over anyway, so it doesn't really do much. I mean, you'd have to conclude then, considering that they're taking on more long-term money with Hawes, it doesn't improve their cap situation much for this year, so I guess they think that that's an upgrade over Stevenson.
Or maybe it goes back to what I said, that maybe they just wanted to get rid of Stevenson at practically all costs.
Yeah, maybe so. And maybe the Clippers are the only ones who, I'm sure they had plenty of discussions. But, yeah, I mean, but at that point, you know, if you're not really in that much better of a situation, you could just waive them to go away as well, rather than taking on Hawes at, you know, basically another $12 million over 2 years beyond what Stevenson's guaranteed money was. That's so I think they must believe that he actually is going to help them.
Well, they definitely missed Josh McRoberts last year, and at least I didn't. I knew he fit well with that team. It was important, but I didn't realize.
I knew Josh McRoberts, and Spencer Hawes is no Josh McRoberts.
He's not, but if he can be a little bit of a substitute, maybe that's the difference between them. Yeah. Sneaking into the playoffs and not.
Yeah, but as I said, I think that, you know, Al Jefferson is going to play 35 minutes a game, and Spencer Hawes doesn't really work to me as anything other than a center defensively. So, yeah, his spacing, if he's hitting his shots, which he didn't with the Clippers last year, could be helpful offensively. But, I mean, you know, I know Clifford is a magician with some of this defense that he's been able to get, but, man, like, Hawes Jefferson front court, you know, whatever spacing Hawes provides, I mean, he's not a good enough shooter that as a stretch four, he really scares you. It's as a center when you're playing a five out system that he really is valuable. So it's, I mean, you know, and you might have a few minutes a game where you're playing with him as the center, but Al Jefferson is your center.
Right. And that, I'm 100% on board with you with where Clifford, this is going to fall on him. He did a great job with some limited defensive players 2 years ago, an okay job last year. There's reason to have faith in him. I don't have that much faith that he can make Jefferson and Hawes work, but I'm willing to give him a chance. Like, if you're the Hornets, what was their alternative? Like, they weren't going to have the cap space to get some top-end player. Hawes is talented. He can do things. You know, he can shoot. He has skills. I don't know. Maybe you just bank on Clifford putting it together, and if he doesn't, he doesn't. What else was going to happen anyway?
Well, I'll tell you this. I would rather have Biombo than Hawes.
I would, too. In the right and fit, Biombo can't play with Jefferson, though, on either end, I don't think.
Yeah, no, that's probably true. But, I mean, Biombo is someone who I think, at the very least, you could re-sign for a decent contract and trade. I mean, he's someone who's mobile and can protect the rim and get at least a little better finishing inside and actually catching the ball this last year. And you know, his qualifying offer is $4 million. Is this now mean that he is not going to be retained? You would have to imagine, since they already have Zeller and they have Vonleh. I mean, this also, to me, means that they must not think much of where Vonleh is at right now either.
Yeah, that's what scares me. I really liked Vonleh coming into the draft, and he pretty much had a redshirt rookie year. And I came around on Cody Zeller last year, too. I think they have some good young players at that position. I don't love, you know, Spencer Hawes being in front of them, stopping them from getting minutes to develop. But I also think Spencer Hawes isn't so great that if these guys, if these young players are good, they can overtake him. They could push Hawes to the bench, and maybe that's the best case scenario, is you have a veteran who's okay, but the young players have to earn their minutes. They have to pass Hawes level to get on the court, and so they have to earn something, and maybe that's good for the team's culture.
The other thing, too, is it's reported that they're going to waive Barnes. I mean, for $3.5 million next year, I mean, granted, he's going to be getting up there for sure, and you wonder whether he can keep that up, but he was definitely worth more than that salary last year, I thought. Guys who can play average defense and, you know, hit in the high 30s on threes, those dudes are pretty rare. So, and this is a team that really struggled for shooting. He'd probably be the best shooter at the wing positions on their team if he were to be retained. So it surprises me that they're going to move on from him as well. The more I think about this, and we've only had a little bit to digest this, and I haven't read anyone else's takes on it yet, but I'm starting to find this more puzzling. I mean, if Stevenson is really that terrible, you just waive him or even stretch him and pay $3 million over the next 3 years of his salary, rather than pick up those last 2 years of Hawes when I don't think he really fixes any weakness that you would have had. And now you're going to waive Barnes, who to me actually would probably be a little bit more helpful next year than Hawes would be.
I'm with you on Barnes. I think teams that have cap room, because he'll be waived in June before his contract gets guaranteed, teams that have cap room left from last season should definitely look into claiming him. And, you know, I don't know exactly what the timing's going to be if the Hornets follow through like the reports have said and waive him. You know, if another team, if something else comes along, that team could still waive him and pay him just $1 million if their plans change. I'd be really aggressive about putting in a bid for him.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, even do the Hawks have enough space for him? He actually could be another wing guy for them, although he doesn't exactly fit in with their kind of kumbaya culture.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're going to be losing Damari Carroll, so I would be interested in doing it. But if you're not going to lose Carroll, I mean, obviously they have a very tight margin for error. You wrote a really good piece on what their situation is a little while ago. I wouldn't want to put even $1 million into that space if I thought there were still a chance they could keep both Carroll and Millsap.
Yeah, and yeah, we'll see if they can or not. That's a whole separate podcast that is rather complex. So, all right, anything else to say on this trade before we get to your hometown Pistons?
I don't think so.
All right. So the other trade that went down, we haven't had a chance to talk about it yet on the podcast with all the finals stuff last week, was Ersan Ilyasova from the Bucks to the Pistons. And then it was, going back to the Bucks, it was Caron Butler, and who else am I forgetting? Oh, Sean Williams.
Yep.
Both of whom are non guaranteed for next year, right?
Right, and surely getting released. But Butler for sure, because his guarantee date is at the end of June. Williams, they can keep around and figure out if they want the cap space or not, and then release him. But
yeah, it was pretty funny. Butler, this the Racine... the paper in Racine, I forget what it's called, sent him a text message because that's where he's from and he was going to be back again with the Bucks, where he already had kind of a rough go of it the previous year. And I guess they wanted to do a story on him returning and he texted back, "No story, I'm going to be a free agent." Apparently, pretty certain that he will be released, at least he is. So we'll start off from your Pistons perspective. What do you think of this trade?
I like it. I think they were going to have a big hole at power forward going into next year. Greg Monroe's probably going to leave. He took the qualifying offer, essentially giving up millions of dollars of guaranteed salary just for the right to leave Detroit as soon as possible. I don't think anything that happened last year is going to change his course on that. So I think he's gone. And you look at the free agents of who they could have gotten, the restricted free agents are always tough, and I know a lot of Pistons fans are dreaming about Draymond Green. That's obviously not happening. Maybe if you make a huge offer at Tobias Harris and are confident he can play small ball four, maybe you could pull him from Orlando, but that's a risk. So you look at the unrestricted free agents going down the list. LaMarcus Aldridge and Kevin Love, those are pipe dreams for a team like Detroit. Paul Millsap, maybe, but that's probably a stretch too. And then if you go down the next best unrestricted free agent power forward, Josh Smith. obviously not happening for Detroit, and that's a pretty far drop from the other guys. It only goes downhill from there.
Well, you could say that Josh Smith was a stretch, too, all the way until 2019.
Bazing!
Sorry, all right, we've just... our ratings have plummeted here. But anyway, yeah, so I guess the question of this trade, it's kind of a challenge trade, basically, to say... would you rather spend $7.9 million on Ersan Ilyasova, who then is a non-guarantee of $8.4 million the next year in 2016-17, or would you rather have $7.9 million in cap space this year? The Bucks apparently, you know, basically this is a salary dump for them. They thought that they'd rather have the $7.9 million. The Pistons thought, hey, this guy can shoot. He'd be good for Stan's system. You know, to open the floor for pick and rolls with Andre Drummond, and we think that we can do better with our $7.9 million acquiring him than spending it in free agency. What do you think?
I think they were both right for where their teams are. I think, you know, like I said, the Pistons, there weren't other small forwards who were viable for them on the market, or I'm sorry, power forwards for them who were viable on the market. Ilyasova is a good shooter. He spaced the floor next to Andre Drummond. He seems to fit in what Stan Van Gundy wants to do. I don't think the Pistons could have done better. For the Bucks, they have a real asset in Chris Middleton's small qualifying offer and the cap hold that'll be. So this is their time to take advantage of it, to create cap space where you can use that cap space, then go over the cap to re-sign Middleton. So I think the timing was right for the Bucks to have cap space. The timing was better for the Pistons to have Ilyasova.
So why don't you explain, because this actually applies to Reggie Jackson as well, for the listeners, how it works with restricted free agency and your cap hold, of how that can be an advantage, as you just talked about.
Sure. So all free agents continue to count against the cap until they're either signed by a new team, re-signed by their current team, or renounced. There's, you know, a bunch of different numbers where they could count against the cap, but it's essentially a percentage of their previous salary. And it's 100% on up. So some guys might be 250% of their previous salary. If they're on a minimum contract in certain ways, it might be 100% of their previous salary. But there's, you know, it depends on their type of contract. So when you have a player like Chris Middleton, who was on a minimum salary, he's going to have a very low cap hold. And that's how much will count against the cap this summer for the Bucks. His cap hold's about $2.7 million. He's obviously worth a lot more than that, well more than $10 million, I think, probably close to, if not a max contract. So the Bucks could agree in principle, keep this hush-hush and say, all right, well, we're going to resign you for $14.7 million, let's say. But we're going to do that after we've taken care of all of our other business. So that essentially gives them $14.7 million minus the $2.7 million cap hold of just wiggle room. So they have $12 million in essentially created cap room to sign other players, to take a player back in a trade, and then they can go over the cap to re-sign Middleton.
Yeah, all right, that's a good explanation. And the purpose of the cap hold is supposed to be to kind of prevent exactly what you're talking about, because when you have a cap hold for someone, it's basically a projection of how much they might be signed for in the future based on their previous salary. When you have young guys who are coming off of kind of rookie deals or second round deals, as Middleton was, same with Reggie Jackson coming off of his rookie deal, you know, then they're making a lot less than they probably are going to be worth, and the cap hold system doesn't necessarily ramp up to the level of what they're actually going to make if they're good. For a lot of other guys who are coming off of that and just aren't any good, you know, then yeah, that's probably, the cap hold is perfectly adequate to project what they're going to get. So you can take advantage of a loophole in the system, basically, because you can exceed the cap to re-sign your own guy. So you basically use up all of your cap room while you have this low placeholder in there, and then you're allowed to exceed the cap to actually give that guy his real salary. The only issue is, you know, the guy might get an offer sheet, and once that happens, it starts the clock ticking to where you lose the space if you match it. So it can be really difficult. That's what happened with Chandler Parsons last year. But for fans who aren't up on that, that's kind of the way that works. And it's with a lot of restricted free agents this year, we're going to see that principle applied for a lot of teams, the Bucks and Pistons certainly both among them.
Right, and the key is you have to have cap room to take advantage. So the Warriors could have been in this situation with Draymond Green because he's making very little and is due for a big raise. But whether his cap hold is, you know, just a couple million dollars or a full max salary, the Warriors aren't going to have cap room either way, so they can't take advantage of it. And that's why I say the Bucks made a good move to dump Ilyasova's money, so they're really maximizing their cap room, taking advantage of the situation they're in.
So how much space are the Pistons going to have if Monroe does not return?
I've got them at about $18 million, I think, was my last estimate.
And that's even with Ilyasova, right?
That's with Ilyasova, yes.
Yeah, so that's actually, I mean, there's not really that much of a difference, I don't think, between having, you know, $25 million or $26 million and $18 million for them. So, yeah, it does make sense that they would bring him in, and they still will have be able to bring in someone on a max contract. What do you see as this team, you know, before we got into any specific names, what do you see as this team really needing to take the next step now that you have a potential starter at the four in Ilyasova?
Well, I think, you know, you'll probably have Reggie Jackson back at point guard. Every indication is the Pistons want to keep him, and he wants to stay. Kentavious Caldwell-Pope is a solid option at shooting guard. There's room to upgrade, but there's no urgency there. Ilyasova at power forward. Andre Drummond is the franchise player at center. And that just leaves a huge gaping hole at small forward where they need to find somebody, ideally a 3-and-D type of shooter, to spread the court around those Reggie Jackson, Andre Drummond pick and rolls.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, Brandon Jennings will presumably be back. You don't know how well he's going to play. You know, we might see them go with both Jennings and Jackson in the backcourt. Jackson, with his ridiculous wingspan, has some ability to guard shooting guards. But yeah, I mean, when you look at it, Caldwell Pope and Meeks are both shooting guards. You have the two point guards, Jennings and Jackson, and really no NBA quality three man. And KCP is probably too slight to really guard a lot of three men at this point. Meeks is too short. So yeah, I think that they will be looking for someone. I mean, someone along the lines of like Damari Carroll, Danny Green, even though he's more of a shooting guard. There's actually a lot of pretty decent veteran wing types that they could probably overpay for, frankly, especially if we're going to get them to come to Detroit, given where they're at as a team right now in the success cycle. But yeah, I mean, is that the sort of move that you anticipate them making?
It is, and I think part of that is a product of that's what they need and that's what makes most sense. Part of that is a product of their coach is also running the front office, so he's not going to be patient. He's going to want somebody who can come in, and Damari Carroll's the guy I look at, and I think a lot of teams with, or fans of teams at least, and maybe even the teams themselves with holes on the wing, think of Damari Carroll as, oh yeah, we could get him, we could overpay him, no problem. Well, only one team's going to get him. A lot of teams want him. He's going to be well over $10 million, or at least he should be. So it's, I don't quite see it as deep as you do. Danny Green would make some sense, and I don't think he's as good a fit at the three as he is at a two, but he'd be fine there. Ditto with Wesley Matthews and then shifting KCP down. Like, I agree, KCP is too slight to play the three regularly, but depending on what your other option is, where you go down the pecking order of small forwards available in free agency, maybe you just live with that.
Yeah, I mean, Stan's going to have his work cut out for him getting this team to defend next year. And he's definitely a great defensive coach, but with the youth on the roster and really knowing that you can point to right now as a stopper, maybe that'll change in free agency. And Drummond has the talent but hasn't really defended at a high level in his career yet. It's going to be interesting. I mean, I think they actually are going to probably score better than people expect, you know, with the floor spread like this. But defensively, it's going to be a struggle, I anticipate.
I think so. I mean, we've seen for a couple years Pistons fans, like Kentavious Caldwell-Pope looks like a great defender because you're just used to watching the Pistons. And then you look around the league a little bit and you say, okay, he's okay. You know, he's solid, but he's not a stopper. He's not a guy who's like in contention for an all-defensive team or anything near that. You know, he's a good defensive player to have, and I think defense will be a priority over the offseason.
All right, why don't we get to the Bucks now. How much space are they going to have now that they have moved on from Ilyasova and they're going to waive Butler and waive Sean Williams?
I've got them about $22 to $23 million right in between there. That's with Jared Dudley opting in. I don't know whether he will or won't, but if he doesn't, I think they'll re-sign him for about the same amount, so I don't think it matters too much.
Yeah, I think he actually can do a little better. If I were him, I would opt out, especially considering his age, his injury history. Yeah, I probably would try to see what I could get on the market with him. I mean, he's kind of part of the plan now to play as a small ball four, which he did last year. So I think at the very least I would opt out and see if I could get more years on that same salary. But I think he was probably worth more than $4.5 million last year at least. What do you think of that?
I would have thought the same, and I do think the same, but I never would have thought a team would have to give up a first-round pick to dump him. So I'm wondering if NBA people, for whatever reason, have a different perception of him than we do.
I would wager that most NBA general managers, at least after this year, don't. I mean, he was terrible that last year, but as by his account, he was really injured, and that's why he was so bad on the Clippers. So I think it was. I think he really rehabilitated himself, and when you consider his last couple of years in Phoenix and then last year in Milwaukee, that season with the Clippers looks like the outlier. And he's a smart guy too, so hopefully, and a decent shooter, so you would hope that he might age a little bit better. I think he can get more, but we'll see whether he opts in or not. That's going to be another one of these kind of fascinating player option decisions.
Yeah, well, I think he wants to stay in Milwaukee. I mean, at least he says he has. I know everybody says that, but he genuinely seemed to fit well there and be happy. So maybe he gets a similar salary and secures himself more long-term.
So what they really need the most here is a center. They've got Michael Carter-Williams. Then they've got Middleton, presumably, whom they're going to re-sign. Then Jabari Parker and Giannis. So they definitely need a center, someone who can finish pick and rolls with all those guys, hopefully, who will prevent you just from switching among all those guys, which I think you would see a lot of. So Tyson Chandler has been talked about with them. Brook Lopez has been talked about with them, assuming he opts out. There's a report that they would make offers to both of those guys, and they certainly have the money to do that. And it's a very deep center market this year as well. So you think they probably will be able to get someone. Zaza Pachulia then can go back to a bench role. He's done yeoman's work as the starter, but probably a little overmatched in that role, especially at his age now.
Exactly. And those two guys, I think, would be very good fits. Chandler fits a little better in their hyperactive defense, though I wonder a little bit, as he's getting into his mid-30s, how much he can exert himself on that end. But at least what he's been doing, he seems to be a good fit in how they want to play, and he can definitely finish pick and rolls. And Brook Lopez, a little different type of fit, but I think Jason Kidd showed in Brooklyn that he knows how to use Brook Lopez around an aggressive, mostly small scheme. And
I got to disagree with you on that, because you remember Lopez went out for the season, and that's when they turned it around. So he didn't really even play that much under Kidd. They were like 10-21 or something at one point, right around when he went out for the season. But I do agree with you, though, in general, because Lopez is someone who's not that great out on the floor, but is pretty decent taking up space at the basket defensively. So I think that when you consider all the athletes they have and their aggressive scheme, that they can kind of limit the damage that he might cause out on the floor. I think he would be a good fit, and he also would provide some offense. His good touch would also be helpful when guys like Jabari or Giannis want to go down in the post.
Yeah, good call on that was Plumlee who was working in. But I think they could use Chandler more so, and Lopez a little bit in some of the ways they used a big man who's not a stretch player around these hyperactive defensive first guys who can spread the floor.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing they might do too is they could go try to get another 3-and-D guy who can shoot, or maybe a kind of gunner type backup point guard who'd be a little better than Jared Bayless, and then maybe go more on the level of someone like Robin Lopez, Omer Asik, although I don't like his lack of offense for that team, but maybe try and get two guys so they have a little more depth, and especially shooting on the wing for times when Giannis and, Jabari is not really a three-point shooter yet and is coming off the injury. Really, their only good shooter is Middleton. So they might need more shooting as well. Maybe they'll go in that direction.
They could. My hesitancy with going toward the wing is, they have these good young players, with Giannis and Jabari. And I wouldn't want to interfere too much with their development with somebody who can step in and maybe be a little, and Chris Middleton. I'd rather give them minutes to develop. I like this as a young team, and I think in some ways this could be their moment, and that's why I like going after Brook Lopez and Tyson Chandler, because they can help them advance in the playoffs and maybe even build up the trade value of some of these guys as they win. That could be their path toward contention. But on the wing, it's just more of a direct impediment to the growth of some of those young guys.
All right, so I sent you the list over here. We got a few more quick hitter news items to get through since we haven't had a chance to do that yet with the finals. Mike Malone hired in Denver. Your thoughts?
I don't think it's a great fit, but there's some talent on that roster, and I think he's a good coach, so I think they can both feel each other out over time if there's patience, and I think it could work out pretty well in the long run.
Yeah, Kevin Pelton wrote a piece today saying that Mike Malone doesn't play at the highest pace, and Denver's most successful teams have played at a higher pace. It could be that Malone just didn't think that that was a great fit for the Kings roster, and he'd be more amenable to playing at a higher pace, and he certainly can improve the defense. I think that was their biggest issue last year. So he's someone who I think deserved another shot as a head coach with how they managed to play in that time before Cousins got injured this year, and he was, the Kings decided to fire him. So I think it's a decent hire. I'm sure everybody would have loved to have seen D'Antoni there, but also D'Antoni, he's an older guy. I think he has certain higher salary expectations. This is a team that, is not going to be contending anytime soon, and Mike Malone probably had a little bit more realistic salary expectations for that job. So maybe that played in as well. All right, so here's another one. Jim Boylan, L-E-N, not L-A-N, not the former Bulls interim coach, but the Spurs assistant and former Utah coach, hired or about to be hired as associate head coach as Fred Hoiberg's first assistant in Chicago. Your thoughts there?
I think that's fine. It's not anything that gets me excited.
But he's on the Spurs. He coached with the Spurs.
That's a nice positive, but so did Jacque Vaughn.
Yeah. No, Boylan did interview with the Jazz last year as well. Ended up being Quinn Snyder who got that job. But I think Hoiberg liked him. Certainly, it does bode well with both Hoiberg and Boylan coming from the Spurs system that the Bulls will have a little bit more dynamic offense, push the pace a little more, move the ball a little more than they did. And I think that that's really kind of where they can improve the most on that team with some of the individual offensive talent that they have, if they can get a little bit more cohesive of a system than they had under Thibodeau.
Completely agree. I think all the work Thibs did with defense, that's not going to wear off in 1 year. The player's going to remember some of those principles. Hoiberg obviously can coach defense a little bit too. So I definitely agree offense has got to be the priority at this point.
Then also, in light of that, David Pick, out of a European reporter at my former home, Basketball Insiders, tweeted out that part of the reason Boylan left is he realized that he was not going to be the successor to Popovich, and that is widely assumed to be a Torre Messina.
Yeah, I read that as more of a prediction than a report, though I went back and forth a little bit on how he meant that.
I've heard similar rumblings as well, just kind of in my own conversations. But I think that that's – and Messina, if you think about it, why is he going to leave Cheska to come over and be with the Spurs unless there's some sort of an understanding that he at least will have a chance to succeed Pop? So I think there's probably some fire with that smoke there, but obviously it's not guaranteed, as you said.
Didn't he go to the Lakers a couple of years ago? And maybe it was a different situation. I wouldn't be surprised if he becomes the Spurs coach, but as we talk about Popovich's coaching tree, maybe they can get somebody to come back, somebody who's been successful already as an NBA coach elsewhere, looking at Atlanta, maybe.
Yeah, no, maybe that's true, too. So we shouldn't assume that, but that was a report. I took it as a little bit more actual report than you did, but we'll see what happens. So a couple others. Dirk is going to play Eurobasket this year. A couple of people asked me on Twitter whether I felt that was a good idea. As long as they don't play him more than 25 minutes a game, I think it's fine.
Yeah, to me, it's whatever Dirk wants to do. He's earned the right to play.
Joel Embiid had reportedly another setback. His navicular fracture was not healing as well as had been hoped, as a scan revealed. So now, there's some thought that he's not going to play Summer League. I don't know that they officially said that, but they said that he did have a setback. And there was even some speculation that he might sit out even a whole nother season, which obviously would be kind of a disaster for the Sixers. What's your reaction to that news?
Yeah, it's tough to say without knowing the medical specifics. If he doesn't play Summer League, my reaction is, so what? You know, guys go to Summer League, and teams don't even play him all the games. It's a nice thing, but he's had a year's worth of practice, and that matters a lot more. If he misses a full season, that's obviously very, very scary that he can't get on the court yet.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, one other thing that this does is it makes the idea that they might select Jahlil Okafor more realistic.
Do you think they're just trying to scare the Knicks into trading up?
Well, maybe. Maybe not. I mean, I wouldn't say that, like, this is just, they totally just made this up to do that. But it might be an ancillary benefit to that where, you know, and I think Phil Jackson probably would love Okafor in the triangle. So if you have that threat, and we know that Sam Inkey has had no problem with just selecting the guy he knows another team wants. He did that with Elfrid Payton, and he extracted a 2017 first-round pick out of Orlando for the privilege of moving down or moving up two spots to get Payton ultimately. So I think it does increase their leverage in such a situation if the Lakers were to pass on Okafor and go with Russell. I guess Russell would probably be your biggest contender there at two. So something else to think about. Another report from David Pick, Nikola Jokic, who is going to be a Denver Nuggets draftee that advanced stats really like. He said he's going to be going to Denver next year. He's someone I saw at the 2014 Hoop Summit. Excellent shooter, extremely skilled, big guy, but also incredibly unathletic, at least the last time I saw him. But he's been killing it in Europe, and the statistical translations love him, so he's someone to kind of keep in mind as a skilled big that Denver might have. And then one more thing, Kevin Arnovitz reported that the Hawks are bracing that Carroll, as you alluded to earlier, might get a deal of 4 years up to $50 million. You think he might get that big of an offer?
Yeah, absolutely, because there are so many teams. I think there are a lot of teams fans, and I think this probably extends to teams who think, well, if all else fails, we could get Damari Carroll. And only one of them is going to get him, and it's going to come down to a point in free agency where teams realize it's going to be him or a big drop to the next player, and they're going to start bidding.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, if you're starting off at a little over $12 million a year, Carroll is worth that for next year probably. But, you know, he's in his late 20s, so are you going to be paying him that much for his age 32, age 33 season? That's where it gets dicey, but that's how free agency works. And with the cap going up, some team might say, hey, we need him for these next 2 years. He's not going to be terrible the 2 years after that, even if he's a little overpaid. So you pay him market value on the front end and overpay on the back end. There's also a lot of money around the league where you might say, all right, you know, we're not going to spend this on anything better. Why don't we just overpay this guy who we know at least is going to be a pretty good 3-and-D guy for us?
Exactly. It comes down a lot of situations to, would you rather overpay this player or not have him at all? And if you don't have him at all, you might not have anybody who's any good. It's not a fun question to answer, but a lot of teams, I think, would rather just take him and hope for the best.
All right, well, so that's pretty much it then. Thanks for helping me get through that news. I usually have my guests recommend something. I totally forgot to mention this to you beforehand, but anything that comes to mind that you want to recommend for our listeners?
Oh boy, you're putting me on the spot. I know you do this, and I wasn't ready.
Well, I should have reminded you. It's my fault. I mean, I could just find something to talk about it if you want while you think of something.
Yeah, stall for a minute.
Should I sing maybe like a little Sound of Music or something like that? I guess we could. One thing we could talk about too. I mean, we haven't talked about the finals at all. What's your give me your finals prediction for what's going to happen? Is it going to go seven, or you think it sticks with the Warriors? Maybe it'll close it up.
I think the Warriors are going to close it probably in six. I wouldn't be surprised if it goes seven, but I think the Cavs are just starting to show their fatigue. I think they're starting to show they're out of answers. And the Warriors have just been the better team throughout the whole season. I think eventually, at this point, that's just taking hold.
All right, well, why don't you give us this? Why don't you give us a Boston restaurant recommendation? You've lived there for a while. That'll be a good one for our listeners who are go to Boston, or any dorks who want to go to the Sloan Conference next year, a good place to eat.
All right, I can do that. Sunset Cantina down on Comm Ave. Good beer selection, good food, good environment. That's where I'd go.
All right, yeah, what should you order there? What's the best dish?
A lot of people like the nachos. I like the chicken wings and fajitas.
Awesome. All right, well, yeah, let's go there next Sloan, assuming I make it out. It's always good to hang out and dork out about cap stuff with Dan Feldman. So thanks for coming on, man. We really appreciate it. Good to get your brand of cap knowledge with these teams that you're really familiar with.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
All right. Where can the folks follow you on Twitter, by the way?
I'm at Dan Feldman NBA.
And anything you've written that you want to plug recently?
Yeah, last day we wrote a couple things at Pro Basketball Talk looking at the finals, one about how bad LeBron's teammates have been historically, and one about how much small ball is going on in this series and how it really has gone above and beyond anything we've ever seen.
Awesome. Yeah, no, that's definitely true. I know David Locke, who's a broadcaster for the Jazz, always says that series get smaller as they go along, and that's certainly been the case in this series. So what was your methodology there to determine, like, how small the series was? Did you just do, like, the height or what?
I didn't want to get distorted too much by, like, it was the point guard 5'11 or 6'3. So I just did a pretty simple percentage of minutes going to players 6'9 and over. And in 2012, in game one of the finals, the Heat had the lowest percentage in 30 years. This series has already produced seven under that. These teams are going small more than we've seen as long as basketball reference data goes back.
Yeah. No, I mean, and the amazing thing, too, is how well both of these teams have defended, even though they are small. I mean, that's traditionally been the limitation of that. But with the three-point line, it seems that, like, smaller teams can actually defend better now, and that's one of the big differences. Like, Mozgov, I think, has taken out more for his defense out in the perimeter than it was even, you know, his inability to score.
Yeah, I think the Cavs have sort of stumbled onto that, but I think the Warriors, that's their identity, is they can defend small, and that's why they've been successful.
Yeah, no, and it all starts with Draymond Green, you know, who plays a lot bigger than he is, obviously, at 6'7". All right, well, thanks again for coming on. You guys can subscribe on iTunes, Google Dunkdown, go to Real GM. There's a link to iTunes or XML for your favorite podcast player on there. You can follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. I usually am live tweeting all of the games. Danny is en route to Cleveland, I think, as we speak, and he's going to be there tomorrow. We'll see whether he's going to be talking about a Warriors championship or a Game 7 in this epic, extremely highly rated series. So we will talk to you all tomorrow night. Thanks again for coming on, Dan, and we'll talk to you guys then. Bye.